Right now, we're going to bring back Brian Kenny from MLB Network to moderate a panel on the use of analytics in contract negotiations. Brian will be joined by panelists Lonnie Murray, Burton Rocks, and Jay Sartori. And I'll quickly introduce each of them. Lonnie is the first and currently only Black female players agent certified by the MLB Players Association and one of very few women on that side of the negotiating table, boasting a roster of over 30 amateur and professional players. Murray has 16 years of experience advising and representing players at all levels of the game. As the president and CEO of Sports Management Partners, Lonnie has made her mark as a highly regarded baseball agent in both the US and international markets. We are also joined by Burton Rocks. Burton is a New York Times bestselling author, social media entrepreneur, and sports attorney. He has co-authored 8 books, including Me and My Dad, a baseball memoir, and co-founded the social media platform Chat with a Star. He is the founder and owner of CL Rocks Corporation, a sports agency based on his own trademarked quantified intangible sheet analytic model, which he used in negotiating Paul DeJong's then record-setting contract extension in 2018. In 2019, Topps issued an official baseball card for Rocks. And finally, Jay Sartori. Jay is Senior Director of Baseball Analytics and Operations with the Detroit Tigers. Before joining the Tigers in 2016, he worked at Apple, managing the sports and entertainment categories of its App Store. He previously served as an assistant general manager for the Toronto Blue Jays from 2010 to 2013 and as the director of baseball operations for the Washington Nationals. Thank you all for joining us. Brian, take it away.
All right, Scott, thank you very much. Hey, do you guys mind if we start with a little curveball here? Lonnie, you good with that?
Yeah.
Burton, welcome. Are you good with that?
Sure.
And Jay, you have no choice.
Yeah. I'm in. If they're in, I'm in.
You know what's interesting? I don't know if you caught me at the very top of the program. I was talking about, you know, what sabermetrics has been blamed for and then maybe improving the game. There's a lot of things that ruthless efficiency has wrought on the game. There's no question. And just before I went on, I was prepping for this and, you know, I'm at home now. So I didn't see the email. Major League Baseball announces experimental playing rules to be tested during this minor league season. The email just came out this afternoon. I'll throw a few at you. In AAA, the size of first, second, and third base will be increased from 15 inches to 18 inches. We've got an interesting subtle change. It'll be a little bigger. Maybe that will help stolen bases, et cetera. In AA, that was in AAA. In AA, the defensive team must have a minimum of 4 players on the infield dirt, basically. You have to have 4. Can't play in the outfield. Can't play that shift, the guy out in right field, the second baseman out in right field. There's a step-off rule in high A. And then there's in low A, you'll be limited to 2 step-offs per plate appearance. And then there's also going to be an automatic ball strike system, robo-umps, in low A Southeast, what they're saying. And then low A West, there'll be on-field timers implemented, which they say, I'm not sure what this means exactly, but that they'll be used in addition to the timers that are used. You know, there's a pace of play clock right now in AAA and AA, but there's going to be more enforcement and more timers out on the field. Lonnie, let's start with you. Your thoughts on all of that. A few tinkering here, experimental things in the minor leagues.
I'm not for surprising guys with that right before they show up for spring training. They did this a couple of years ago. Doing that is completely disruptive. I'm not for it at all.
Is it that much as far as like stolen bases? You kind of, that's a subtle thing. The defensive positioning, it's just, I don't like that, by the way, but why would that be disruptive?
What I've heard from guys in years past, that it was just a couple of years ago, that the same sort of changes were kind of implemented right as they showed up for spring training, and it just throws them off mentally. With all of the changes that we've had going on, all of the disruption, a lot of guys right now still haven't heard from their team on when they're reporting. Some guys have heard that they're not reporting until mid-April, late April, for a second round of spring training. I just think it's too much. That's okay. Why. Now, as far as you know, the whether or not it's going to be effective for the game, that's a completely different discussion. I don't like robo umpires. I'm not about that. I think it takes the fun out of the game. As far as stealing bases, and it's not, that's not a strong part of our game. I would like to see it more, but it's not something that has really been encouraged much as of late anyway. So I'm not sure what the motivation is.
Yeah, well, to encourage that, I think, you know, and I like that it's kind of you're just a little bit closer. If it's 3 inches on both sides, up from first to second, you've gained 6 inches, you know, it's a shorter distance. Burton, go ahead, let's get you involved. Burton, what are your thoughts on all the changes?
The defensive shift is interesting because that goes back to Ted Williams, the Williams shift. So I don't know, that's interesting. players don't even know their report dates in cases. So this is a little bit unsettling. So that's my initial reaction.
Okay, Jay, your thoughts?
You know, I think baseball has a unique opportunity and or is uniquely situated with having, you know, so many minor leagues that they're able to, you know, institute some of these as tests and see if it can improve the overall entertainment of the game for the fans. I think that's probably a big focus is making the game as enjoyable for our fans and spectators as we can. And I understand that, you know, there could be challenges certainly to the players adapting or even to the teams and staff with these new rules, you know, and those are certainly, you know, some difficulties, but hopefully from this, you know, we can come and, you know, get some information to would make it, you know, maybe a more enjoyable game overall.
Just to let people know, and people probably know this, that, you know, the baseball has been doing this with the Atlantic League. Now it goes to the affiliated minor leagues. You know, I understand what you're saying. Lonnie, give me something. Again, I'm just springing this on you. Welcome to the panel.
I mentioned earlier that was my biggest fear last night and why I couldn't sleep is I was like, there's probably going to be a lightning round. Okay.
I wasn't even glad if breaking news.
I'm on. My hands are spinning. Okay.
Lonnie, give me one thing that you would advise baseball, like, or even as a fan, what's one thing that you would change? Say, hey, why don't we try this in Major League Baseball?
I would like to see probably like we just talked about, I would like to see more action in the game, the stolen bases. I would like to see it more encouraged by teams without...
Okay. All right. My thing, Burton, you're next. My thing is the pitch clock. I think, you know, we've got to improve the pace. And I understand that there's some arguments against it, but man, baseball used to be a lot faster. Burton, give me one thing that you would advise the league. Hey, why don't you try this?
I like the sacrifice bunt. I mean, I want to see a little bit more of the intangibles, the enjoyment of the game, not just the long ball. I really would advise the league to try to allow the players to market their individual charisma, because if you think about it, that's the part that made baseball great. You know, Buck O'Neill used to tell me that when baseball went through hard times, the passion brought it back.
All right, Jay, I know you work for the Tigers, but you must have a thought on this one from watching all the baseball you do. Give me one thing you would ask the league. Hey, why don't you try this?
I think pace of play and action in the game, how we can, you know, in any way we could do that. And quite honestly, I don't know if I have the answers. I know I don't have the answers to that. And I think that's why some of these experiments maybe be good to see how we can positively impact that. I think sometimes what you may believe would actually result in a change may not, you know, actually have that impact. So I do think, you know, doing some testing and getting some information on what would be best. I think that's, you know, a good idea.
Was the information ever released on how these changes, how they had an impact on the game?
You mean from the Atlantic League last year?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure. I know there was, I'm not sure. I won't answer that because I really don't know. I know baseball was going to, they were thinking of moving the mound back. There was so much pushback from that, which I get if you're a pitcher, they didn't do that. But a few of these things, I think they're all kind of positive. Look, we saw a lot of innovation in Major League Baseball last year. I didn't think I'd like seven-inning doubleheaders. I love seven-inning doubleheaders. I didn't even mind. Jay, let's go back to you. What do you think of the guy on second base in extra innings? I thought I would hate that. I ended up thinking, no, it actually kind of forces the action. I kind of like it.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it made some exciting games. I remember, you know, just watching other games that we weren't involved in and you know, being interested in it. And I sort of, I go to other sports for rule changes in some ways. If you look at, you know, I'm no expert in the NFL, but, you know, if you look at the league now and the way that they're playing games as compared to, you know, how they were playing games 20, 30 years ago, there's a considerable difference in how their play is. So, you know, personally, I do think we should, you know, just like be open to ideas about the game changing. And I think it happens organically, but you do have to, the NFL has been open with their rule changes. And so, you know, I try and take an open mind to how these things, you know, will play out.
It was kind of forced innovation. Burton, what were your thoughts on some of the innovative things that happened last year?
Runner at second unnerved me a little. I like the pitcher to have this idea of continuity. But I did like the seven-inning doubleheaders a lot. I thought that they made the games more manageable for fans who have time constraints.
Right. Since games used to be 2 hours, now they're four or three plus. We all have time constraints. Lonnie, last of the lightning round, and then we'll get to the topic ahead. But
I too struggle with starting a guy on second. I did not like it at all. I am in between on innovation. The game has gotten long and a bit boring for me. I like the shorter game. And so if there seems to be a trade-off between the two, so I'd like it to take a step back a little bit and make the game more exciting.
That's, again, I just wanted to respond to news. I'll be filling in tomorrow on High Heat for Christopher Mad Dog Russo. So I will weigh in. I might get my judge's robe and my gavel, and I'm going to boo the defensive positioning. That's so terrible. Like, like you said, you must play this way. I say use your smarts, use strategy, play your defensive players wherever you want, and make the offense adjust. All right. We're here to talk about analytics in contract negotiation. Let's start with this. Jay, again, director of analytics for the Detroit Tigers. You're keenly aware of all of these things that are out there. What is it like going into negotiations? How often are these kind of new metrics, either StatCast or kind of the recent things that have popped up the last 10, 15 years? How often are they brought up in negotiations?
So I think I'll sort of separate it into two groups for me. Whether you're looking at players in the salary arbitration system or if you're looking at free agents. And so just starting with players in salary arbitration, a lot of the new metrics aren't referenced just because we are governed by, you know, the basic agreement as to like how we, you know, what the rules of negotiation are and what the backdrop of that is. But I do think, I apologize. I'm in my office here and my auto light shut off. But looking, when you're talking to the free agent market, I think the use of analytics is, you know, it's for teams to prepare themselves. And it's no different than maybe teams had been doing in the past when they prepared themselves for any negotiation. But there's so much more information readily available to teams now to break down a player. And certainly those are things, you know, in the free agent market, you're recruiting players because you like them for certain reasons. And, you know, in many ways you want to communicate that, you know, it's players, and they'll certainly get that full, you know, full bear of the information when, you know, if and when they join. But I think it is really imperative for a club to be prepared as to, you know, why they're going after this player, why they like this player, why they think he can help the organization and the team. So it's an integral part.
Okay. Lonnie, again, from the other side of things, negotiating on behalf of a player, what do you use? What do you look for? What do you present?
The same as he said with arbitration, it's a little bit different than the free agent and the amateur guys. How we use analytics and negotiation really doesn't much come into play. It typically comes down to dollars and opportunity. the number of teams that are interested in your player, how many guys out there are like my player, and how much a team is willing to pay. Now, if we can find ways to distinguish our guys with some advanced, you know, stuff, then great. That plays to our favor.
Okay. Burton, how about you?
I think the intangibles have come into play more for me, especially with players over the age of 35. When you're dealing with older players, it's going to be about who is valuable to the franchise and why. And analytics are important. They've come into play, but I think that intangible factor has come into play probably 50-50.
Okay. Yeah, well, can you give me an example? Paul DeJong is all signed up, but DeJong's the defensive metrics are very much in his favor. He's hit for power before. Why would you need to, what's intangible about Paul DeJong that we're not seeing, since his tangibles are pretty good?
Well, I'm not using him. I mean, it would be more for an age 35 over player, where the intangibles would be what he's done in the past, how his metrics haven't decreased. And then you can go back and talk about players who gave up 3 years of time during World War II, came back from a break because of service time, and the metrics were phenomenal. And if you were going based on straight analytics, they might have been driven out of the game.
Hmm. Well, no, there's no question there's more bias against older players now. I guess, tell me there, like, how often, and Burton, let me go back to you. How often do you go to, like, StatCast data, either exit velocity, barrels, or get into the weeds on that stuff that might not be in his what we call results data?
Well, without getting specific, you do get into that, you know, advanced analytics. But again, you're getting more into the fact that this guy's a gamer and he can play the role of veteran and mentor to younger players.
Okay. If you go that route, Lonnie, what about you?
The same thing. That includes the lower dollar guys, the non-roster free agents, the bench guys. If you can identify something in that player, then you can make something work both on the intangibles as well as on the analytics side and use it to your favor.
How much agreement is there, Jay, these days? Because I guess, you know, we have this image of, you know, Scott Boras in his binder and, you know, he's the king of the cherry picking stats. But now it seems like, I mean, I would go to you and say, Jay, this guy's a 4-win player. Let's be honest. We know what this is worth. Like, is there just a kind of a basic agreement on that, or is it not like that?
I think you can have agreement in many cases. I think a lot of the times it's, you know, we're talking about a market negotiation where, you know, players on the free agent market are, their value is determined by, you know, sort of what the supply and demand is, you know, by position. And so you can agree as to what the value of the player is. And it's just, you know, how much, how much one team can allocate to him versus another. And I think that's a big part of the equation. But, you know, sort of hit on the points too that Lonnie and Burton hit on as well. I don't think it's purely analytics. Obviously we have all of our information and our models and our, in our background data that can, you know, forecast what a player may do. But I do think that what they're saying is, like, the player's ability to be a gamer, to really care, to have that, like, passion is very important and something that really goes sight unseen because you can't measure it. And so for clubs, it's important to blend those two to make sure they're bringing, just like when you're doing hiring for any job within an organization, it's important to have the both.
Burton, tell me how that works then. Like, how do you sell that intangible as far as, converting that into actual value?
Show instances where they've overcome adversity on the field, battled back to win, and show instances where they've helped tutor younger players to battle back to win.
Okay. Lonnie, what about you?
It's the same. It's who sells the best story. So it could even be their off-field endeavors, how they make the team look. It's been as simple as that sometime.
Okay. How about, Jay, because we hear things too where maybe I have a guy with a 4 ERA somewhere, but you know and I know his spin rate is top 10 in the league or something like that, that, hey, this pitch works for him. If he eliminates this, adds this pitch, you know he's better. We've heard that before with guys like Colin McHugh and players like that. How often does that come into it where you're looking really at specific, you know, skills or, you know, StatCast things that can be measured these days?
I think that's something that every team is looking for. You're trying to find, you know, an undervalued player, a player who maybe you can influence him to make a change, you know, through a coaching staff or through, you know, usage of a pitch or, you know, mechanical change that makes him, that unlocks a talent that is underlying that maybe has gone unnoticed. And like, that's the ideal situation where you could see something maybe that not everybody else does and say, okay, we're going to target this player. We're going to bring him in. This is the plan that we have for him. We're going to, you know, do this. And then that, when that successfully works and you uncover something, like that's the, you know, that's what I think everybody is shooting for.
Right. Because right. It's hard to, you know, gain an edge, but this seems to be what's happening now. Lonnie, do you have any examples of that, or is it more players in the minors or players in the majors that you're dealing with, then does that sort of thing exist in your world?
I think I missed the first part of the question.
Just are you looking at specific skills, meaning we've got spin rate on this guy's fastball or curveball, or we've got eggs, even though he hit 220 in Class A, look at his exit velocity, that sort of thing, specific things you can sell.
Yeah, I think a lot of teams definitely look at, you know, the spin rate and exit velo. As far as my personal feelings about it, that's a whole nother discussion. But there's so much fluctuation between teams and what each team values, I focus on that. So on the amateur side, if I have, you typically have a certain number of teams that are in, or the, even if all the teams are interested in your guy, you're going to look at the most viable teams for that player. As an organization. And then you're going to figure out, okay, what do these specific teams value? And I work from there.
Okay. Burton, how about you?
I think it's based on, I have two words, confidence and trust. And that's what's with management, particularly with ownership and upper level management. If they trust in your ability to give them players that enhance their organization, I think they're going to be more willing to work with you.
But they're tangible things. What if someone, because there's players like this where, say, you have an older guy, and I'll say, Burton is, you know, if I'm sitting there with Jay, I'll say, Burton, his chase rate's going up, his walk rate's going down, his bat speed has gone down, blah, blah, blah. Like, how do you measure that or combat that as that enters into the conversation?
I would combat that by saying that on my metrics, I don't think that it's as big a factor as the weight that you're placing on it. And I would be respectful about it. And I would give them the qualities that I would place weight on.
Jay, how much does that happen where that conversation is happening, where there are specific trends that you can point to that are kind of aging process skills?
You know, you could always in any negotiation point towards, like, you know, people's weaknesses. You know, even for the best players, you know, if you have so much info, you could pick them apart. I think generally speaking, like when you're in a negotiation, you know, to recruiting a player, there's obviously you're making that phone call because you want that player to join the organization. So there certainly already implicit is the fact that you like the player for one reason or another. And, you know, and then it would come down to some, you know, valuation or, you know, some trends that you are seeing and how that would play in. But I do think both sides like have to be respectful of one another, because, you know, the club calling or vice versa, there is mutual interest in having that conversation. So like you're actually, you know, you're taking the other person's side. It's just, all right, where are we going to meet in the middle if we can get something done?
Yeah, Lonnie, take us behind the scenes if you can, because I'm not even aware of how that works, your conversation with.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah,
Are there raised voices, or is it all calm, or how does that work?
I think the only raised voice I've ever gotten in baseball was with the Players Association, but that's another. And so, no, it's actually, I've had very respectful dialogue. And the awesome part is that they're, you know, again, we all measure and value different things. And sometimes if you're not familiar with an organization, or if there's been a change in leadership at an organization, there might have been some shifts in what they value. And so you're walking in not knowing. And so they can throw something on the table, kind of like, you know, you know, getting us at the beginning of this discussion, and we could just sit there and be like, I'm going to have to get back on you on that, to you on that, because, and it's generally pretty respectful, but like Jay was saying, you can say anything in a negotiation, and that you value. But like Burton then said, you know, and Jay mentioned, you can come back and say, but we value this and we know what's going on with your team, because that's obviously very visible. And this is what you should be valuing. And so don't try to screw with us on those little numbers that you just brought up.
All right, Burton, how about you? What is the tenor of most of these conversations?
Polite, respectful, short, because I just think less is more. And a lot of the relationships I've built with the owners over the years, I mean, they kind of know my story of health adversity. They know where I'm coming from, and they know why I'm so locked in on these intangibles. And I can point to players in history that have been game changers for organizations that were not Hall of Famers, but were fantastic and helped them build the marketing value of their franchise.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. I could say Tommy Henrik. He's not in the Hall of Fame, all reliable, historically, lost 3 years to the war, came back, helped the Yankees win championships. So you use and you compare players. I mean, you're not going to compare everybody to Tommy Henrik, but I'm just giving it to you. I don't want to use a personal example, but I'm just saying I've used that in examples talking with upper level management.
That's a great example. And then even you've got on the amateur side, you've got guys where teams are correlating bat speed to future success, but a guy gets into a game and he can't hit. You've got, again, I won't use personal names, but there's one kid in particular, you know, gets drafted in the fifth round with average bat speed, but can barrel at the ball and defend the strike zone. So.
Mm-hmm. And Jay, I'll throw it your way, because it does, to your point, Lonnie, it brings up a point, youth baseball, especially. Look, we respond to who's popping the mitt and who's hitting the ball out of the yard. But is the kid good? Like, how do you go between tools, which are still very measurable, and get all the attention? And well, this kid seems to be succeeding and seems to be a winner, but he's 5'10", he's throwing 91, whatever it is. How do you try to balance that?
I would say that's probably the most difficult, task in all of sport, or at least from our seat, is, you know, projecting player performance, particularly as they are further away from the major leagues. People and organizations that are the best at that are generally the most successful ones. And I wish there was a magic formula. And I'm sure that there are times where, you know, as myself or people that I work with had, you know, undervalued someone or overvalued someone for these exact reasons, you know, that maybe a tool was overvalued or performance was overvalued. I know from my personal experience, like, these are things that we, you know, talk about in depth, like how performance relates to underlying tools, how to blend that, how to work it with, you know, the player's desire to make himself great. It's really difficult. And I could understand, you know, Lonnie and Burton from your side, like, being frustrated. Sorry about my light. Being frustrated. I think clubs are equally facing the same difficulties in trying to assess, you know, what is actually driving future success.
Yeah. Lonnie, follow up on that. Yeah. What about that? What is happening out there?
Yeah, for me, the frustrating part is the guys that get devalued that you know instinctively can perform, and that, you know, they're just athletes, but, you know, maybe their ball didn't take 6 seconds to come from the sky. Or, you know, it's those sorts of things. Or, you know, guys, teams going to the cages and, you know, measuring the analytics, the exit velo. And now you have kids that are relying on their velo, but, you know, there's no movement on the ball. And we've all just witnessed a prime example of really great velo, but getting knocked all over the place because there's just nothing to his ball. period. And that was visible to me. I had people dogging me out over like being a naysayer. But, you know, when you've got, you know, a couple catchers sitting back there saying, I'd love to hit him, you know, but teams just missing that and placing scouts, placing all this value versus on pitchability. That's the frustrating part. Seeing kids get into the, you know, that can't pitch without looking at an iPad. Hitters who are more eager to look at their exit velo than they are to actually, you know, have a feel for where the ball went or how it felt or what their body did or didn't do to have success or, you know, what caused the failure. That's the frustrating part about this.
Okay. Burton, that sounds right up your alley. Can you add to that?
I would like to see a study on the number of kids that are being injured because of the stress on velo, the emphasis. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see a study. You know, my dad has talked to you in the past about tendons and ligaments. I just feel that the next generation of parents are ruining it for their kids with all of this velo, velo, velo.
No, we have many conversations at the network, at MLB Network, about that. The problem is, I remember Al Leiter telling me he came from one of his kids' games, and this is a son who's now, you know, at Vanderbilt, he's a top pitcher. But at the time, his kid was 14 years old. He said he was at a game. He saw like exactly what happened. This kid pitched 5 innings, was great. This kid went 4 for 4. He said the thing that got tweeted out and got attention was some kid came in the middle of the game and hit 93. You know, and that was the one thing that got out about the game. So like we all kind of talk about it. And yet, what do we respond to? Like a shiny object. How hard is the kid throwing? Jay, your thoughts on that? As far as we know, it's a craft. And yet we all want speed.
Yeah, it's, you know, and I understand sort of the development in you know, youth and throwing hard and damage, you know, to arms. And, you know, that's real. You know, I think the part of what we're getting at, too, is, you know, internally, and we're always talking about being able to blend these types of skills with, you know, the intangibles or the performers, right? Like who, and I think, you know, from a club perspective, you're trying to take all of the information that you can and make the best decisions you can for the better, you know, the betterment of your organization. And it's hard. It's really, you know, it's, and I think it's easy maybe to tend to some data points or any, you know, information that you could really put your finger on. And it's easier to analyze that. And maybe that's why that's happening. But, you know, I think just sort of in general, you know, people tend to gravitate towards, you know, big numbers or, you know, standout performances in the sense of, you know, fast fastballs or, you know, really long three pointers or whatever it may be.
All right. We're just past the halfway point, and why don't we get to some questions? I know I didn't take questions earlier, so I'm going to try to get to a few here, and anybody can jump in on this. This is from Chris. It's a good question. How much do you feel analytics has affected veteran and middle relief player contracts? Anybody want to take that? Hello? Okay, Lonnie, how about you?
I knew you were going to do that. Sorry, now I get to start sweating.
You don't have to talk about specifics, but you know, about in general. It was a deep market this year in relief pitching.
Yeah, and this probably isn't a good one for me to answer. The question is, what is my feeling about the use of analytics and how that was too overly measured in how they paid some of these relief pitchers? Is that what you wanted to hear?
Yeah, how was it affecting?
Yeah, I think it absolutely helped some guys needlessly. I think there are some guys that were definitely overpaid as a result of their analytic numbers or on numbers is that weren't based on trend.
And okay.
I mean, it could hurt. I mean, help some of my guys in the future. It'll hurt others. But
right.
It would just be nice to get some consistency.
Burton, what are your thoughts on that? Again, it was a very deep relief pitcher market. Not a lot of big multi-year deals went out.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think it's a barometer of the future only because we don't know how deep the market's going to be every year. And then I just see the economics of the game forcing ownership and upper level management to assess priority points differently. They'll have different indices of, I want to say, reflection in the near future.
Okay. Jay, your thoughts on that?
I think it's a lot of, you've got 30 clubs, you know, valuing players and, you know, using different sort of levels of information to assess, you know, which players that they're going to, you know, go after. And I think, you know, that maybe as much as anything is indicative of, you know, a larger contract may go to a player that a club is really, you know, they believe that they found something there. And so I, you know, it's hard to speak, you know, sort of to the market as a whole when, you know, we're sort of assessing from, you know, the Tigers, just like, you know, what is best for the Tigers. And that's generally like where our thought is.
This goes to something we talked about a little bit earlier, but, you know, we can say that it was as a result of analytics, but the bottom line is that teams do overpay on players that they just want when they just decide that this is who we want, period. And, you know, as agents, it's our job to kind of use all the tools available to us to sell the guy that teams don't want.
Okay. Lonnie, here's a question you could start here too. Have analytics, this is from Alexander, have analytics become valuable to all teams at this point, or are there some who are less sabermetrically inclined?
I definitely think that all teams use some form of analytics. I think that we need to start being more realistic in these discussions. Not us, not you, Brian, I don't want to offend you. But we talk about analytics like it's some newfangled tool or measure, but analytics has been a part of the game for forever, since before I was born, and I'm climbing. And so it's just continues to evolve just like the game has. And so all teams use it. All people in baseball use it. Whether or not they use the same terminology is a different discussion, but we're all generally talking the same about the same thing, which is why when Burton and I and Jay were talking earlier about discussions are generally friendly, because even if I show up without, you know, the right word, it's no different than scouting, you know, it plays.
Okay, Burton, how about you? Are there differences between teams in and how they view analytics?
I think that in the last decade, teams have weighted analytics more, but I think a lot of things are cyclical. Years ago, you know, when Chadwick invented the scorecard, everybody fell in love with stats, but then you had other decades in baseball. So I think that baseball is undergoing a global shift. How can they market themselves? And if they see analytics as a 50-50 partner in the future, teams are going to be 50-50 in on that. If they see it as less, they're going to say, you know what, charisma, we need to bring this game back. We've had a pandemic. We need the charisma to bring this game where it should be. I think it's going to be a situational discussion, but I do see that a lot of teams are favoring intangibles now as much as analytics. So it's the pendulum swinging a little bit.
Jay, what are your thoughts as you've seen, or how aware are you of how big other teams' baseball ops departments are? Like when you deal with the Dodgers or Yankees or some other club.
And name them specifically.
I will pass on naming specifically. We're you know, it's our job to be competitive with these other, you know, as running an analytics department, is our job to be competitive with the other analytics departments. So our goal is to have as good of information as any other team in the league, just like a scouting department will be competitive with another scouting department, and a team as a whole is competitive to win baseball games. So we're certainly aware, and it is certainly it's a bigger thing now, because when, you know, my dad was telling me about baseball and I grew up and he was telling me about Ted Williams, he was telling me about Ted Williams' stats, right? And the stats have changed. Some have, some haven't, but they were shifting Ted Williams. And now we just have the information to do it on a mass scale. we have the ability to bring in database architects and software developers and data scientists to take a look at large swaths of data and draw conclusions from it, as opposed to, you know, the technology that wasn't present previously. And so I think now that's why it gets so much talk, is just because you can talk about it. It's just the information is there, as opposed to before, it was just much easier to talk about scouting because, you know, that was just an easier topic to broach.
Okay.
I got one for you, Brian.
What's that?
I got one for you. I was talking to an exec at a club, and he called up about one of my guys that he hadn't been very kind to in the past. And I guess the Rays had called about him, and he figured that if the Rays were calling about him, they must have missed something.
Right. Well, listen, that you're right. That happens all across. Anytime, even for us at the network, the Rays make a trade, you're like, what are they up to? They see something, right? And teams have developed that, that reputation. It's no question. Here's another question. This is from William, who said, have you ever used, and Burton, why don't you take this one first. Have you ever used expected stats or other advanced analytics to try and project future performance and value for players signing free agent contracts? So, XWOBA or opponents XWOBA, have you used those?
I mean, I've used advanced stats, but again, I guess I don't want to not answer the question. I mean, again, what I've really used is my own kind of, harmonization between some of the advanced analytics that we will go through and really the intangibles, and talking about where they fit as a package in the totality within that organization. And so that's really where it's been for me personally.
How about you, Lonnie?
I feel the same way. In addition, it's like, you guys seem to really value this and you guys really like that, and the player may not have it, but I also know that you like this. And so why not both of us take a ride down this alley versus the one you're trying to take me on?
Okay. Jay, we have one here, and I want to get to this, and this is a little, it's sort of off topic, but I think there are so many students out there. This is the question they want answered. Jay, as an aspiring individual who would like to be involved with baseball operations, how do I go about getting my foot in the door? That's the basic question. Jay, again, there's so many kids out there college people. What would you tell them?
Yeah, I get this question a lot. And I think there's a few things. It's obviously persistence and just being on top of it. Obviously, you know, clubs are posting associate positions or internships constantly, and making sure that you're on top of when to apply for those is really important. And it's not just clubs. There are, you know, businesses that work on the peripheries of baseball and with baseball teams that are good ways to get your feet in. So make sure you're really aware of those opportunities. That's really important. But the other thing that I always say is, you know, your education is really important because, you know, as a student, you know, that's the presentation that you're going to give to a potential future employer, and not only what is on your resume, but your ability to, you know, speak to your past experiences, what you're doing sort of extracurricularly around getting involved in, you know, if it's baseball analytics, doing some research or working with your sports analytics club or your school's baseball team, and just showing that you've got the passion, the desire to do this. For me, I think the most important thing when we're hiring into our department is we really want to hire people who really want to work in baseball. Because I know from experience that if you're not truly passionate about the game, it might wear you out, right? Like you may not have the fortitude to put up with the ups and downs and the difficulties and the long hours. So if you really don't want to work in baseball for that reason, I would recommend, look, you know, there's a lot of other great industries to work in. And so make sure you're really passionate about the game.
And just to let all the students out there know, you worked for Google before you went to the Tigers, correct?
Apple, actually.
Apple, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, everyone makes fun of me because I'm like the biggest Apple fanboy in the world. So it was Apple.
outside of baseball than came into baseball, that sort of thing. And at the time it was like, whoa, look at this. Now, you know, really not so outside of the norms. Lonnie, what would your advice be if we were actually not virtual, but if we were there in Arizona, all these, and the level of education in these, I call them kids, I'm old enough to call them kids, my kids are this age. The level of education for a lot of these students is amazing now. What would you advise them about trying to get into baseball?
The number one thing is being determined. You know, opportunities may seem limited, but your determination will, people will read that. Similar to what Jay said, you know, go to your school's athletic program, get involved. If it's free labor, but just do it. It depends on how passionate you are about it. If your school doesn't have it, go to the junior college. If you're not at a junior college, get it in, go to your local travel program, just something, but get there, have something to list on your resume where you can apply it.
Okay, Burton, your advice?
Take a list of all the adversity you've overcome, see how it meshes into baseball, and try to put that on your resume in addition to your academics.
That's interesting. Is that well received? How would that work, Burton?
Well, I mean, you have to write a character letter for school, right? When you go to college, they ask for a letter about you. So maybe, you know, you've had health adversity, you've overcome it. And you say, well, this kept me going. This is why I chose this. This is why I chose that. And an organization might say you'd be an asset to them.
I can tell you that if that's great advice, because, and he's probably going to kill me, Tyrone Brooks. When we are at the winter meetings, I direct everyone to Tyrone Brooks' LinkedIn page. And there's lots of opportunities, but using that advice that Burton gave you, especially in your opening letter, will probably undoubtedly cause him to take another look.
Interesting. Okay. I hadn't thought of that. Good job. Thank you. And I know that a lot of the people out there appreciate it, because they're looking to get into the game, and they obviously, if they're registered for this conference, they do have a lot of passion. Let's get to another question. We got a few more minutes here. Let me see. Do you think that intangibles and potential that vary needed to get signed for another team? For example, Trevor Bauer signing with the Dodgers instead of staying with the Reds this offseason. Burton, why don't you take that as far as intangibles, or does it really come down to money, or how often does it not come down to, you know, the dollars?
I've always thought it's a combination of the right fit emotionally and the right fit for the family. I mean, from the player's perspective. And I think that from the organization's perspective is, how can they better market our product? So that's the way, I think it's a 50-50 weight, but in some cases there might be heartstrings that have a player remain loyal to that organization, want to come back or want to go to a different place.
Lonnie, how about you?
It comes down to what each party measures and finds value in. And I think, like the situation that you just brought up, I think that was personal decision based on what the player especially felt would define his future success better than where he was at.
And if the money's close, right? I mean, at a certain point, you know, the money dictates, doesn't it? I mean, that's what I've
seen. Money dictates all of this. We're not having a discussion, you know, at the end of the day, because money determines all of it, period.
Right. Here's another question. This is from Jonathan and Burton. I think this is right up your alley. So are there any consistent methods used to measure a player's intangibles, or is it only anecdotal? Example, confidence, ability to perform under pressure, coachability, etc. Burton, take that.
I think it's a combination of anecdotal and then pointing to statistics in a game, like, let's say, batting average after the seventh inning in clutch situations. So you get a little bit of statistics and you get anecdotal and you can mesh the two.
Okay. Lonnie, any thoughts on that?
Same thing, combination, period. I wish they used it more on the amateur side when it comes time for that player's draft year. You know, they used to discount them when, it seems like there's so much pressure, but that's an unbelievable amount of pressure that I don't think determines how they would be in game situation once they advance to the next level. But it's a discount tool.
Okay. Here's something. I have no idea the answer to this, so this is a good question. This is from Noah. who said, when or if advanced metrics and Statcast data are allowed to be included in the arbitration process following the new CBA, how much of a role do you think it will play? Because you still need to tell the best story to the arbitrator. I know, and Jay, maybe we'll start with you on that. But I'm always amazed when it's like, well, he went to arbitration and they brought up saves. And I'm thinking, saves? What? So, like, who are these guys? And is this going to change?
Yeah, there it's a well-established system that's been going on. You know, I've been now, this is my, you know, almost 15 years in baseball, and I started at the commissioner's office doing a lot of work in salary arbitration, and it's a lot of the same arguments now that we were making back in you know, 2005, 2006. And that's the nature of the system. You know, it's evolved a little bit, but definitely the, you know, it's spelled out that, you know, Statcast information is not, you know, to be included in that. And so I think, you know, if that were to change in any way, I think that would potentially be a, you know, a radical shift in how salary arbitration is, you know, conducted. And, you know, and I think the funny part about salary arbitration is, you know, both sides, the club side and the agent side, are looking at the same information a lot. And, you know, I always say this in negotiations on salary arb is, I say, you know, reasonable minds can draw different conclusions, and we will literally be looking at the same numbers, at the same players, at the same comparables. And I say, this is how I see it. And they're like, okay, I see it entirely different, but I agree with what you're looking at. And it's an interesting system in that way that, you know, sort of past history has dictated how negotiations are framed for the future.
Is it still, it still seems very old schoolish though. Is it still like that when you go in front of these arbitrators? Lonnie looks quizzical. Lonnie, is that the case or not?
Well, you say old school, that's just, I like it.
I'll give you an example. Was it Dellin Betances who was used like in the eighth inning, and he was used in high leverage by the Yankees? This is a few years ago. And then he went to arbitration and they held it against him that he didn't have saves. How am I going to get saves? Like, so it makes no sense.
They just didn't tell the good story. They need a better better person representing them. That's all. Because it is. It's who tells the best story. You can have somebody go in there and, you know, sell a guy on, you know, for wind effects or full inning holds. And, you know, whoever is most compelling in their storytelling.
Okay. Bert, your thoughts on that, how arbitration has worked with you?
I just think that both sides want to come to some sort of an agreement, and it's just basically how you get there. And I think that certain times the numbers will play, you know, more to one's advantage than the other. I can't quantify that.
Okay. I just wonder if they're still using RBIs. I mean, no, you know, no disrespect intended, but come on. You know, RBI saves. It just seems like, wow, 1983 is still happening, and it's still out. Let me ask you this, Jay. I think you know, that's an interesting point. You know, about arbitration now and how it's working. The Trevor Bauer deal, though, and I wrote an essay on this after it happened, was a shift. Now, Trevor is a different sort of guy. He threw out, oh, I want to go year to year. I'll do 1 year deals. But he did do like kind of a max deal for 2 years, because that third year option is not as much. You'll likely decline that. But he's going to, you know, he's getting $40 million for you know, per year for 2 years. Do you see that as a trend, or do you think more players will, you know, want to do, hey, pay me for my performance short term, but I want a lot of money? How do you think that happens, Chet?
Yeah, I think that maybe it's in two parts. I certainly can't speak to the situation, you know, and with regard to Bauer, I don't know, but I think maybe it's creativity from both sides. You know, there's, you know, players thinking about their careers differently, and front offices thinking about how they can structure things differently now. And I think, you know, maybe actually via more information, people are assessing, you know, maybe I can do it differently. Maybe I can go shorter deals and that works out better for me. Maybe, you know, maybe he values his flexibility in a short term deal, and he can, you know, take his career in other avenues after a couple of years. So I do think maybe information and having both sides being like empowered by information is probably leading to some different creative ideas, you know, in contracts or in sort of roster construction or in, you know, in-game usage.
Again, and the crux of this, and Burton, I want to throw it to you next, is that a club pays for that. Like, you know, they need to pay. Like Bryce Harper, the Dodgers made, you know, reportedly an offer of, I think it was $40 million a year. Like, let's go 4 years, $40 million. So there, you have to pay for real if you're not giving them the long-term objective. Do you think that's a wave of the future or no?
Well, I don't want to comment on specific situations, but I still say players are so individual and their family situations are unique. I don't think you'll ever get a trend. I think every situation is just unique.
Okay, Lonnie?
I definitely agree with Burton that every situation is unique. As far as whether or not it would be a trend is also highly determined by whether or not he has success.
The issue, though, is that it's kind of, you know, in the old days, a guy is hitting the market at age 30 and a team is still willing to give him 6 or 7 years. And now we know clubs are not doing that. So in order to combat that, that's why I think it could be a trend. It hasn't happened. The players that you represent or that you even speak to, not that you represent, that you speak to, there doesn't seem to be a lot of interest in, hey, pay me big, pay me short.
That's personal. But every player is so different in that regard. But that was a little bit different of a question, I think. When we're talking about whether or not the industry is going to change its trend and only do these short-term deals, I think the industry itself would love to get away with that. I don't know that players as a whole will agree to that. You know, again, you have players that will sign contracts later. You have a bunch of guys right now, this crop that's coming up, that really have had significant delays on their career. So in a few years, players are going to generally be older. So more of them will be looking for longer term deals to get them over the hump because there's a lot of risk in waiting.
Right. Oh, no question. I'm saying this needs to work for the player as well, but it does when you jump from, hey, we're going to pay you AAV $23 million to AAV $42 million. Now we're talking, it goes both ways. Jay, do you see that as a possibility or you use that? Even like your club say, like when you get to contending status saying, hey, we don't want to be on the hook for 7 years with a pitcher in his 30s, but we will load up almost like that same amount of money for 2 or 3 years.
I think the way that we would, you know, take a look at that or is you sort of explore if you're in the market for those types of players, then now you've got these various comparables out there who have, you know, players who are signing shorter term deals and longer term deals. And then, you know, you can actually reference both of those and now the directions that you may want to go. And I do think, you know, as both Burton and Monty said, like this is a, you know, player individual decision as well. It's a, you know, sort of, they need to feel comfortable with, you know, where they're going, you know, both geographically and for their family, or particularly when it's going to be a longer term deal or, you know, whether it's going to be a shorter term deal, I think is going to have some, there's, I'm sure, quite a few life factors that need to be considered in all those situations.
Right. No question. 40 million solves most all of them. That's the thing.
Yeah.
And it's got to work for both sides. And certainly, you know, that's going to come to, you know, with the next CBA round. There's no question about that. All right. We're done. We had a few surprises. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Relatively good. There's smiles. So that's not so bad.
You did that on purpose. I knew it was going to happen. I knew
it. Of course it's going to happen. Jay kept turning his light off, but he never left. He was thinking about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I was going to sneak out. That's why I had to do it every like 20 minutes.
I knew what you were doing. I know, but yeah. you hung in there.
I was fanning myself from below.
Oh, well, great talking to you guys. So all three of you, Jay, good to talk to you again. And everybody, best of luck. And to everybody out there, we hope you all enjoyed it. Good questions. We got to a few anyway. And it looks like we got Scott back up there. Everybody enjoy the rest of the conference for the rest of the weekend. Scott, take it away.
Brian, thank you so much. Thanks to all of our panelists, Jay Sartori, Lonnie Murray, Burton Rocks, for taking the time to share your expertise with everyone today. Also want to thank our research presenters this evening, Rob Maines, Matt Manicharian, and John Shirley for sharing their expertise. Finally, thanking our sponsors for today, our presenting sponsors, Major League Baseball, Rawlings, Sports Info Solutions, and Baseball Reference. We will be back tomorrow at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. So we'll see you tomorrow night.